Good evening and welcome to Bird Calls from the Knoll Foundation Studios here at Red River Radio. Tonight's program is made possible by the Knoll Foundation and the Community Foundation of North Louisiana. And for once, we have a full bank of phone volunteers tonight with Wally Derleth, Sheila Lawrence, and Tim Schnell on the phones. We invite you to call in with your questions about our feathered friends and the avian world at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Cliff Shackelford is our resident ornithologist here at Red River Radio, and he's ready to answer your questions about birds tonight. Cliff is currently the statewide ornithologist for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department, a position he has held since 1997, and he has been an avid bird watcher for more than 30 years. He is also the first author of the book, Hummingbirds of Texas, published in 2005 by Texas A&M University Press, and he has authored more than 80 publications on birds and birding. He and his wife, Julie, and their two children live in East Texas. And welcome back, Cliff. Rainy out there right now, but not down in your neck of the woods, I hear.
Am I on?
Yes, you are.
Okay. Yeah, I drove through the absolute outer edges of Hurricane Nicholas today, and we could have used a lot more rain where I'm at in East Texas, but I feel for those people in true southeast Texas down near the coast that are getting hammered.
Yeah, I'm not sure of our water level up here, but I think southeast Louisiana and Texas have probably had enough water for this year. So anyways, they're, you know, swamplands anyway. So.
Right.
So you are invited. You're listening to Bird Calls tonight, and you're invited to call in again about our avian world and the birds. 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We do have one caller online, but we got some stuff to get through, so please hang on the line. And Cliff, at the end of last month's show, you gave us a conservation tip. Could you refresh our memories and begin this week's program?
Sure. Last month's conservation tip was a strange one, but I think an appropriate one for a teachable moment for our children and even some adults. You know, one of these out of sight, out of mind moments. We talked about, you know, where does our water go when we flush a toilet? What happens to the trash when the trash person picks it up? You know, we think, oh, it just disappears. We don't have to worry about it. But I think if we did know what happens, that it doesn't magically disappear, we might work a little harder to generate less of it. So we talked about taking a kid, taking your child, your grandkid, taking yourself to the local landfill and or the local sewage treatment facility. Yes, I know those are odd, but also bird watchers tend to flock, no pun intended, to sewage treatment facilities because they can host a lot of birds. There's settling wetland ponds that can be great for bird watching. We have lots of state records that have been found at sewage ponds all over the state, including things like spotted redshank and sharp-tailed sandpiper and the most inland record of long-tailed Jaeger at Nacogdoches sewage ponds in the 1970s by my professor, Dean Fisher. Those others, the sharp-tailed sandpiper, the first one I think was in Fort Worth, Arlington area at their settling ponds, and then the spotted red shank, I recall, was in Austin at their sewage ponds. So there, it's really interesting to see what happens when you flush the toilet. So visit these sites. Maybe you'll get to see some birds as well. Landfills, they've really changed waste management since I started bird watching, because there's a bird down in the valley called, used to be called the Mexican crow, now called the Tamaulipas crow, that you pretty much only went to the Brownsville landfill in the early days to see it, and it's kind of dwindled. It's still the place to go, but you don't have a guarantee to see it like you did in the 80s. But I remember going in the 80s, and they had people, the public, going through the garbage, picking out trash. It was bizarre. And the Mexican crow was foraging out in the trash just like the people. But a lot of that's changed. We don't leave garbage out as long. It gets into pits rather quickly. Of course, it's not a good idea for liability to let people do that, pick around in the trash. So things have changed. Even in my lifespan, I've seen the changes. But I also see what happens when we generate a lot of these things. So, again, take a kid to your local landfill and or sewage treatment facility. It's a goofy conservation tip, but again, I think very important, gives the family something to talk about and think about.
Well, I can only speak from a human point of view, but that sounds like a crappy vacation plan. So, however, I'm not a bird seer. So,
That wasn't scripted, Bill. That was great.
That was me. Awesome. You can give us a call right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. You're listening to Bird Calls with Cliff Shackelford. And we already have three lines lit up. But, Cliff, we've got this month's profile species to get through, so let's do that.
Great. The blue-gray gnatcatcher is who we're going to profile today. So the blue-gray gnatcatcher is a petite bird with a soft voice. And let's listen to one now, to the commonly heard vocalization, the thin, wheezy call notes.
And a piercing.
Yeah. And during the breeding season, and if you're within close range, because it doesn't carry very far, one can hear the gnatcatcher's soft song that sounds like this.
A little more melodic.
A little bit more melodic, right. Petite bird with a petite voice. Despite the modifier blue-gray in its name, this bird actually is more of a pale shade of gray with maybe, just maybe, a faint hint of bluish. It also has a black and white tail that it almost constantly pumps and flicks around. With an estimated 210 million individuals across the continental U.S. and barely reaching into southern Canada, the blue-gray gnatcatcher is tied with the chipping sparrow as our second most abundant songbird. In case you're wondering, the most abundant songbird is the American robin, a species that we profiled on this show back in 2017. Gnatcatchers are busy birds that flit around, often fanning their tail while searching for food. As the name implies, the gnatcatcher eats a lot of insects that it gleans while actively foraging around leaves and limbs in our shrubs and trees. This tiny bird is smaller than a goldfinch or a chickadee and weighs less than 3 pennies in your pocket. The gnatcatcher is migratory, often departing south for the winter to warmer climate from Mexico to Honduras. Some gnatcatchers overwinter in our Gulf Coast states, especially where conditions are usually mild, including in the listening area here. Lots of gnatcatchers pass through the Red River Radio listening area, especially during fall migration, where it's worth checking them out in case they're part of a mixed flock of migrating songbirds that might include one or more species of warbler, much to the delight of the birdwatcher. To see a photo of a blue-gray gnatcatcher snapped by James Childress, please visit the Bird Calls page at redriverradio.org.
All right, and wonder if we could train them to actually eat mosquitoes, too, so that would be nice.
That would be great.
Actually.
Yeah.
Give us a call right now. You're listening to Bird Calls at Red River Radio with Cliff Shackelford. Give us a call at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. And if you have a photo or a sound of a bird you'd like Cliff to identify, you can send them to my address. That's W. Beckett, W-B-E-C-K-E-T-T. At lsus.edu. Once again, wbeckett at lsus.edu. George from Bossier and Kim from Jefferson, please hang on the line because Clyde is up first. Clyde from Nacogdoches, you're on with Cliff. What's your question tonight?
I'm hoping he can identify a bird that we saw a picture of in a copy of Texas Highways, and there was an ad that included what was pretty obviously a small bird, almost wren-like in shape and sharp little black beak, but its color was a kind of a streaked light gray or white and blue. feathers, like about blue jay colored blue feathers, you know, streaky on the back and tail. And I've never seen anything like it, and I couldn't find anything in my Birds of Texas that made sense.
Yeah.
Well, it's not identified.
I get that magazine. I don't know that I look at every one, actually. My wife, I think she reads them pretty often.
Hang on here. Clyde, could you turn your radio down in the background? We're getting an echo
yes,
effect there.
I will try.
All right, thank you.
But if this is very difficult, Clyde, for me to see through your eyes.
I understand.
And so you said the word blue, and there are very few birds in Texas or in North America that have blue. There's several jays, of course, that have blue.
There we go.
And so you need to look through the jays.
Definitely not a jay.
Okay, and then there's indigo bunting. There's blue grosbeak.
Definitely not an indigo bunting. We used to, when we were living in Douglas, we got them by the flock.
And then
wonderful little bird.
And, of course, the beloved eastern bluebird.
Yeah, definitely not that, because he's got lengthwise stripes. I mean, you know, or streaks.
Yeah, this is not going to work, Clyde. I'm not going to be able to do it. So,
well, Clyde, do you have the article? You could always clip.
I don't have it laying right in front of me.
No, but you could clip it out and send it to us.
I can do that.
Yeah.
Yes, or for that matter, probably find Cliff's office in the SFA and drop it by there.
Yeah, or if you can call back with which issue it's in, then maybe we can find it.
And which page?
But this is going to be too difficult to do, Clyde.
Well, I was afraid it might be, but then again, you know, I thought you might recognize it just right off.
Yeah, and if I remembered that issue, I would definitely know, but it's not coming to me. So, yeah, sorry, my friend.
I will see if I can find the silly thing and, you know, and get that to you.
Yeah, okay.
You could even scan that page if you had a scanner or take a picture of it with your phone.
In fact, I don't. And we've got a very simple, stupid cell phone.
Gotcha.
No smartphones in our house.
I gotcha.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you very much for trying.
Thank you, Clyde.
Mm-hmm. Bye-bye.
And you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. And you can give us a call at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We have three lines open right now. Kim, please stay on the line for a little bit longer. George from Bossier City, you're on with Cliff Shackelford. What's your question tonight?
I'm having a problem getting close enough to birds to photograph them. I don't have a long lens on my camera. And some years ago, I was at the Red River Wildlife Reserve, and a person came up, was in head-to-toe camouflage, and you couldn't even tell if it's a man or a woman. And I was wondering if that's really effective. I went Sunday to photograph some egrets, and I don't know if I was scaring them away, but I was just wondering what effect, is that a total waste of time, or is there any particular techniques I can use to get closer? If I had a longer lens, it wouldn't be a problem.
Right.
I saw a couple of egrets. And the other question I have is the time of day. I went before sunrise, and I know there were birds there because it sounded like the soundtrack of a movie in the Amazon or something with all the birds. I really wish I could have recorded it. It was amazing. But that's the two questions. Time of day. Is morning the best time? And the other question
is the clothing. Yeah. So let's do the time of day. What you experience is what we call dawn chorus, D-A-W-N, dawn chorus. And that is absolutely the best time to be out for birds because birds have high metabolisms. They went through the night, diurnal birds went through the night without eating. It's been 8 or 10 hours, depending on day length and night length. They're hungry. They're also having to, you know, monitor their territory and maintain it. So birdsong is best in the morning. Absolutely. Now, I'm not saying you got to be out before daylight, but the closer you're there, you know, between 7 and 9 a.m., primo. Now, I'm not a photographer, but, you know, the light conditions are always best in the morning and evening as well. You don't want that bleaching, bright, overbearing sun right overhead at noon. So now to your question about clothing. Absolutely, camo works. Ask a duck hunter why they don't try to hunt with a white T-shirt or a red T-shirt, a solid color, bright colored shirt. Birds are, they see color. So deer don't see color. So yes, a deer hunter can wear orange. That doesn't work on deer. They can't see that. But birds see color. That's why birds are so colorful. They actually see, in addition to us, what we see, they see in the ultraviolet spectrum. So they see extra colors that you and I don't see as humans. So absolutely, camo helps. It breaks up your pattern. You're not just this big sheet of white T-shirt or any color, you name it. But the color is a big feature or a big problem for creeping up on birds, and the pattern. So I think that's a no-brainer. You know, you'll see a lot of photographers wearing khaki and solid khaki. They'll probably tell you you don't need the camo. And it's maybe so, the khaki will let you get closer, but I guarantee you no good photographer, nature photographer, is wearing bright orange, yellow, blue, red, green, you name it, any color. They're just not wearing bright colors. So, you know, invest in some camo. It'll be worth your while. And without the lens, you answered your own question. You need a bigger lens. So you already know that. But in addition to that, get you a $12 camo shirt and another $15 camo long pants, and you're good to go. You'll be in good shape, George.
It just dawned on me, I got a whole box of BDUs from when I was in the Air Force. I could just put them on.
Bingo. unless you're like me, you know, the body shape has changed a little over the decades. So how are you doing in that department?
Well, I think I'm about the same. When I retired, I went straight up from size 38 to 42 to 40, and I finally had to just get into bib overalls because I was gaining so much weight so fast. And I finally put the brakes on that, so I'm back down. You know, when I was in the Air Force, I couldn't just eat anything I wanted anytime I wanted because you had to stay within the weight limit. But
yeah, that's right.
So, well, also, you were exercising constantly.
So after 20 years, when I could eat whenever I wanted, that's what I did.
Yeah.
But I fixed that problem. But, yeah, I didn't think about that. I have one more, I guess it's kind of a simple question.
Okay.
When I was out there, what I thought is probably the perfect place to take pictures of this bayou, this alligator showed up. And I figured, well, I might as well just pack it in. I got a bunch of pictures of the alligators, but the birds, the egrets, weren't coming back around when he was around. Is that the case? Once he shows up, they're gone?
I've seen, I mean, it depends. If they're in the water, I mean, you got to remember, not every bird is paying attention. And the ones that are not paying attention are going to be a delicious lunch for an alligator. Huh. So it pays to pay attention, right? Now, on land, when you see an alligator on land and his whole body's exposed and they're still quick, but not as stealthful as when they're in water and can go underwater. I've seen plenty of egrets cautiously foraging near a sunning alligator that's up on land. But if you know, if you want to get one in the water, or the egret sees them in the water, they're smart. They don't want to be lunch for somebody else, and the dummies become lunch.
Yeah, well, I didn't want to be lunch either. I looked down where I was standing right on the bank, and there was these alligator prints, and I figured it was time for me to pack it in. So,
yeah, just moving down the way and being careful. I mean, there's not a whole lot of adults getting, you know, killed by gators. There, of course, people accidentally step on them in the water, duck hunters, for example, especially in teal season, which is September and things are warm. A lot of those hunters don't take their Labradors out with them because a 60-pound, 80-pound Labrador, guess what it is to an alligator? Dinner.
Sup?
So they don't take their dogs with them when it's warm on the duck hunt in September teal season. So I think it's just, you know, we've coexisted with gators that they've come, they've made a big comeback in the last 20 years, depending on where you live. But where I live, they weren't around 20 years ago, 30 years ago, and now they're pretty plentiful. But I watch where I'm stepping. I mean, I already looked on the water's edge for cottonmouth, water moccasins, the, you know, other hazards, you know, tripping hazards, fire ant mounds. There's so many things you got to look for, and looking for a gator is just one more thing. But I'd get excited if I saw a gator. I mean, not right under my foot, obviously, but if it was 10 meters away, no problem. So yeah, I think they're worth watching and taking pictures of. I've seen some of the coolest pictures of gators sticking their heads up and a dragonfly perching on it, thinking that it's a log or a twig or something, and a beautiful dragonfly on top of a you know, an alligator in the water makes a really cool picture. So maybe you can get a neat picture of a gator sometime. So
I'll send you a bunch of pictures next time you come of gators, because that's about all I got.
Oh,
I got
cool.
A couple of
eaters, yeah.
And what looks like a kingfisher, I think.
Okay.
I haven't crossed this. But listen, Cliff, thank you so much for your help. I appreciate it.
Before you run, George, I had a couple of questions. How about using a blind like hunters, Cliff? Is that something that you would recommend, or that, you know, professionals?
If you've got a big wetland and you don't know where to plop the blind, that's a problem.
Right.
You know, you can't really... Unless it's like a Benny Hill show where you can put your legs through it and creep around, move around like a moving blind, but nobody does that. That defeats the purpose. So if you had a tiny wetland, you could use a blind. But if it's a big, giant one, probably like where George was, the minute you put it down on the east side of the pond, the birds are all on the west side. So it's tough to do a portable blind. But it's worthwhile. It's a great suggestion that Bill made. George, you might think of a little pop-up blind. They're pretty cheap, and that might be worth trying as well. And those are going to be, if you get it from a hunting outlet, it's going to be camo, and that's what you want. Same thing with what we talked about with clothing. You want to break up the pattern. You don't want these big sheets of color X. You want... The camo breaks up the pattern, and it really helps to have it earth tone. And, you know, the hunting has really come a long way in the last couple decades. There used to be just one kind of camo. Now you've got tree bark camo, you've got marsh camo, you've got dark woodland camo. You've got all these different camos now that help you blend into whatever environment you're in. And it really makes it helpful. So that's something else to think about when you purchase camo, is are you going to be in the marsh because you want something that looks more like marsh grass color? Are you going to be in the woods and so forth? That can really help. So great questions, George. Thanks for the call.
Thank you, Cliff. Bye.
Yeah.
And you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. And you can give us a call now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. And we have four lines open now. And, Kim, you have been patiently waiting from Jefferson. You are on with Cliff now. Hello, Kim.
Bill, can you hear me?
Yes.
I just emailed you an audio clip of a bird I heard this last weekend that I could not identify. And I wonder if you have the capability of playing it on the air and...
I don't know, Bill. Can you?
I'm going to find it here. It may not come through, but if it doesn't come through today, we can certainly put it on next month's show. So let me get this up, and in the meantime, Cliff, Phil.
Yeah. So we've not done this before, Kim, where someone did real time recording sent to us. We usually get them in advance and can prep them. So while Bill is looking through his email for it, I want to put a shout out that right now people are probably noticing that this is our peak season for hummingbird migration in the Red River listening area. 99% of our hummingbirds are ruby-throated hummingbirds, and boy, are they packing it in right now. At my house, we've had them for over a week in big numbers. And that will continue for the next couple of weeks and it'll trickle away as we get through October. And then the last hummingbirds typically leave somewhere towards the end of October, early November. So everybody keep your hummingbird feeders out and realize it's four parts water, one part table sugar, no other kind of sweetener. You might have the pink stuff in the house and the blue packs and the stevia. Don't use it. White table sugar, if you're confused about what that is, you got problems, because everybody knows what white table sugar is, and so do the hummingbirds. So one part sugar, four parts water, and put it out in your feeder. And right now is the peak. These are southbound migrants. So you're seeing a lot because your backyard right now, your feeder is a refueling station from birds that might have bred in Missouri or Iowa or Minnesota, and they're passing through the listening area, and they're headed south to Mexico and northern Central America. Ruby-throat's winter from the Gulf Coast states in low numbers. They really peak in Mexico and get through to Costa Rica. There are very few records in Panama, ruby-throated hummingbirds. So, Bill, are we having any luck finding Kim's email?
Yeah, I found the email, but the audio clip is what is called an MP4, which is an Apple iPhone kind of device.
That's correct.
And that's not going to play on my Android. I actually have to convert those in the studio to get those over to something playable on the rest of the world's devices, because Apple loves everything to be Apple and nothing but Apple.
Of course.
So, it's kind of a marketing strategy, but it doesn't work for me. That's why I've got an Android. So anyways, we will get this on next month's show, so be sure to tune in. And in the meantime, I am forwarding this to Cliff right now. Hopefully he'll be able to play this on his computer, and I think you've been able to do that before, haven't
you? Yeah, and that won't be till I get home. So, Kim, we don't work real-time with recordings, I'm sorry to say.
Okay, thank you.
So our next episode for you to pay to tune into so we can play your recording is October 12th, Tuesday night. And so hopefully they'll give us plenty of time. Hopefully we'll be able to pull it up. And then, you know, is it a pretty good recording? Are we going to hear the bird, or is it?
Yes, okay. It's pretty obvious.
Okay. You don't want to spend a minute trying to imitate it, do you?
I don't think I could.
No one can see you, Kim.
And they don't have your last name either, so
yeah,
it's all
mysterious. We don't know what your last name is. It's probably Smith,
really,
Jones, or Brown. So,
yeah,
okay.
Actually one of those.
All right. Well, we'll try you next month, Kim.
And we will definitely have it on next month.
Thank you for the call.
Yeah. And that's a teaser, by the way. Now we've got Kim listening next month, so see,
all right.
See it all works
that's
out.
Right.
Works out proper.
Cool. All right. Thanks for the call, Kim. Appreciate that.
And you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. And guess what? All lines are open right now, so you can get right in at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. And in the meantime, we've got a little bit of stuff that was submitted and a couple of articles. One we're not going to talk so much about right now, but it is up on our program page now, about a mysterious sickness blinding birds that has disappeared just as suddenly it has arrived. And the other one is black vultures are eating cows alive. What a headline. Now, you know, from journalism, that's what you call an overinflated headline.
Yeah.
And now some farmers can legally shoot these protected birds. So talk about that a little bit, Cliff.
Sensationalist.
Yes.
Yeah, so they're more or less ranchers. They're raising livestock. And guess what happens when mama gives birth, whether you're a cow or a goat?
Don't eat dinner right now.
Yeah. You've got afterbirth, and the vultures are there to help clean up the mess. And so there is, unfortunately, we've talked about this on the show, there's unfortunately this thing called guilt by association, because there are examples of vultures going, to the extreme and killing calves. But we don't know, did the mom abandon it? Is the mom not protecting it because she senses something wrong with that calf that we don't sense? There's a lot going on. But there is a program now. There's a federal permit they're going to give. They're going to give to ranchers that have a problem with this. They have to go through all these other methods to try to avoid vulture depredation, but if that doesn't work, then they're going to be permitted to take up to 5 black vultures. So not turkey vultures. Remember, we have 2 species of vultures across this, certainly the eastern half of the U.S. And so the turkey vulture is the one with the red head that's really dominates in much of the country. But the black vulture is more of a southeastern, southern bird. It's expanding north rapidly, and it's the one that is, as an adult, has a gray head. And it can be pretty aggressive. But, you know, the sad part is vultures are doing their job. You know, when cows do die of, you know, all kinds of diseases or whatnot, the vultures are there to clean it up. So it's unfortunate that vultures are our friends when we feel like it, and they're not our friends at other moments.
Well, they're basically part of nature's janitorial staff.
That's right, and we should appreciate that. So anyway, so that's an interesting article. I don't like the sensationalistic title of black vultures eating cows alive. You know, it'd take a family of four 6 months to eat a cow. So it's the afterbirth. And we don't know if you do find a vulture eating on a calf, if it died of natural causes or if it was diseased or what. So anyway, so what else do we have here, Bill?
We have a photograph sent by Chuck Olmey of a osprey in flight. And it's caught a fish, which is, you know,
yep.
That happens.
And typical osprey fashion, they move the fish around before flight to make sure that it's aerodynamic like the bird.
Mm.
And so it's always head first. And so you can see that in Chuck's picture on there. So I'm assuming Chuck took that picture. It's a neat one.
Yep.
Very good.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and you can give us a call now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Any question regarding our avian world and the birds are welcome. And Susan from Long Branch, Texas, you are on with Cliff. What's your question?
Oh, thank you very much. Yes, I live in Long Branch, kind of close to Carthage and Mount Enterprise. And I live down in the woods. I'm off the county road. And one day I was kind of walking down my drive, and I came across the tallest bird I have ever seen. And I thought, it was just standing there, and it had real long legs, and it was gray, had kind of a top knot, and a real long neck. And I thought, gosh, what is that? That's not a great blue heron, it's not. Tell him, what is it? And then I used my Texas bird book, and it appears to be a sandhill crane.
Oh.
And what it was saying, that usually you hear them before you see them. Well, lately, like three will be flying, and they make this clickety-clack, clickety-clack, clickety. I mean, a real unusual sound, but I've lived here 15 years, and I have never seen a bird like this here.
What month did you see that?
It was just about 3 weeks ago.
Okay.
3 weeks ago, I thought, yeah.
Okay, that's pretty interesting. And you're what? Is that Russ County or Panola?
Well, I'm on the line, Russ County and Panola.
Okay.
I'm really in Panola County, but I'm just about a half a mile from the county line.
And so that would have put it in late August?
Yeah,
that's...
August.
You describe the sandhill crane pretty very well physically and the voice too. It makes a kind of a
And this one I looked at it and it wasn't that far from me. It didn't seem afraid of me, and I talked to it, and then it just turned and just walked into the woods. And
I thought,
that was unusual.
And that's unusual, yeah, because they are birds of open prairie. Open grasslands, sometimes marsh. So walking in the woods is bizarre. I don't know. So it was a single all by himself?
It was a single all by himself. Now, I do have a pond on down from there.
Yeah.
So, it's kind of marshy around it.
Yeah. Well, an August record of a sandhill crane is pretty darn unusual in our area. So I think if he shows up again... Susan, try to take a picture, and then also try to look if it has a leg band or a neck band on it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, because it could be a banded bird. I don't know, but I'm intrigued. It's very interesting, and
it was. I thought, I hope he comes back.
Yeah, well, take a picture and send it in if you can. Yeah, thanks so much for the call. Thank you, Susan.
Okay.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
And I saw a Long Branch when they wrote, on the screen where she was from, and I was thinking Kansas City and the saloon in Dodge. So, Dodge City, I should say, in Kansas. You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. You can give us a call right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. John from Fishville, I know you call and then drop. You're having trouble with your phone. Let's hope you get back with us. And in the meantime, we do have some submitted questions. And one of these is, growing up, I learned that if I didn't remove my backyard hummingbird feeder, the hummingbirds won't migrate south.
Yeah.
Is there any merit to that statement?
And we get that a lot. The old wives' tale is to take them down by Halloween or the birds won't migrate south. Well, we've mentioned this many, many times. We don't have that kind of power. Your food doesn't taste good enough for the birds to quit migrating. They are hardwired to move. And some birds, though, will overwinter with us that came from some other place, like a rufous hummingbird. And the nearest breeding is probably Idaho, maybe Wyoming for them, but certainly Idaho. And some of those rufous hummingbirds make a west-to-east migration. Maybe goofy, maybe it's on purpose, but if we didn't have those feeders up, they probably wouldn't make it, especially after the first freeze that would knock out all the remaining native flowers that we put out. Turk's cap is one of my favorites to plant because they start late. You'll be like March, April, May going, where's the Turk's cap? The plant's right there. Why isn't it putting out flowers? They're a little bit late. Just cut them a break. But by May, early June, they're starting to put out their red flowers. And the good thing is, since they start late, they go late. And that means into November, December, until we get a freeze. So if we have a freeze, there goes the flowers, and the birds are super dependent on our feeders. So leave your feeders up in the south. We have mild winters. We have a lot of hummingbirds that overwinter with us. Don't listen to the old grandpa tale of take the hummingbird's feeders down or they won't migrate. We're really not that important.
And I was going to say, give equal opportunity to the men out there for shuffling some, because we're good at that, too. You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. We have all lines open right now, and you can get in at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. And on to another submitted question, and this is pretty important. There's garbage just about everywhere in the outdoors. But what is the worst one for birds, and what can I do about it?
That's a good question. I think probably the worst thing, and we've talked about it, is monofilament fishing line, plastic wire line, hay baling wire. These kinds of things are problematic for birds. So we really recommend anglers, if you've got a big wad of unused fishing line, don't toss it down on the beach on the shoreline. Don't toss it in the water because it's not going to go anywhere for a long time, and something's going to get tangled up in it, including a bird. So I would say fishing line and anything like that birds can get tangled in. There are states that have problems with hay bales, the tine that's used to bound up hay bales, because osprey will sometimes come down and grab some of that hay and accidentally get some of that tine, and then it gets in the nest, and it doesn't take long for a baby osprey that's in the nest for, I don't know, 30, 50 days, however long they're in there, they get tangled up in that stuff. And you and I can't break it unless we have a pocket knife, so don't expect a bird to break free. So there are lots of pictures of young osprey, even adult ospreys, dangling dead from a nest because it accidentally incorporated some nylon string, yarn, rope, whatever, into its nest. So those are really bad pieces of trash for birds, and we covered that. with fishing line. Clean up your fishing line, put it in your pocket, get it into a garbage can. My agency, Parks and Wildlife, puts out lots of receptacles. They're big PVC tubes that you can shove that into and get rid of it, but don't let it blow away onto the shoreline or on the beach. Don't let it fall in the water. It's going to be a problem for years and years with something getting tangled up in it.
Now, if you're in a boat and you get caught up into the weeds or something on the side, I know a lot of fishermen will just cut their line and put a new hook on. Should they get up in there and gather that
well,
up?
Well, they should do their best to try to pull, to jerk that remaining fishing line and let the lure break that's hooked to might be hooked to button bush or a willow tree or something. Let the hook lie in the tree, but try to wind up that fishing line before you leave. It's going to be a matter of time. Something's going to get stuck in it, and it's not a way to go. It's a slow, painful death for a bird to get tied up in fishing line.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. You can give us a call now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. And we have two calls online. Bill, please hang on the line. Jerry from Shreveport, you're on with Cliff. What's your question?
Hi. I have a book by Donald Grutzman.
Krutzma.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's a sound guy, yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, he's pretty good, but I thought I'd try to figure out American Robin songs. It's got they have carols and his sellies. And what's the difference? And have you got any hints on how to memorize these bird songs?
I like using words. You know, I think I don't know if Krutzma uses those, but I can't remember the exact words that using like an echoic or actually not an echoic, like a mnemonic where it's cheer cheer cheerio, something like that. I can't remember what the one is for the robin, but. But I have to think twice sometimes when I hear a robin, because in our listening area, the one other bird that comes close to it, but once you've mastered it, it's not the same, is the summer tanager. Yeah, summer tanagers and robins can sound very similar and give people fits, but once you master it, you'll notice that they're different. So
we have those sounds here if you want to play
okay.
them.
Okay. Krutzma's, he's the best, and I actually had the honor of meeting him when I was in graduate school at an ornithological meeting in the mid-90s, and he is the nicest guy, and I have several of his books, and they're wonderfully written. Do you have the new one that has, I don't remember what's on the cover, maybe a Red Start, but it's got little barcodes, the QR codes, is that the one you have?
I have an older one. It says bird song for the curious naturalist.
Okay.
Yeah. Right to listening.
Yeah, there's a newer one that's only about a year, maybe 18 months old, and it's got QR codes. You can, add that app to your cell phone, and while you're reading along, it's magical that you can scan that QR code and listen to his recordings, and it's just fantastic. It's a great way to learn bird song. So, but look, go online, Jerry, and just Google for, there's all kinds of people that have put up these little mnemonics and phonetics that I'm talking about, where that's a great way to answer your question, how do you memorize these things? For me, those stick in my head. You know, like a classic one is going to be, something like Barred Owl, where it sounds like it's saying, who cooks for you, who cooks for you all. It's not really saying that. It's not a human. It's a human way of putting a bird call into context that we can easily memorize it. So, but yeah, the robin's got one that's got the word cheery, cheerio, and I don't remember the little jingle.
But yeah, I remember something about an owl too.
Yeah,
certain owls got I can't remember the mnemonic, but anyway, they've got a mnemonic too for that.
Yeah.
So, but I didn't know what they meant by this what the heck they call it, carol and hillsillies. That just threw me off.
What's the word you're saying? You're saying caroling?
Carols. Songs without the carols. Only he'll sell you.
Okay. Yeah, see, there's, I don't know how that works either, so.
Yeah.
But
anyway, Cliff, I really enjoy you guys.
Oh, cool. Cool, Jerry. Well, thanks. Thanks so much for the call, and I'm glad.
I'll try to get that newer book.
Well, and you know, you're the first person in the 8 years of our show that we've got to say the name Don Kroodsma, Kroodsma. So
yeah,
I want to put a shout out. To people find his books and look into that, especially the new one with the QR codes. It is really, really cool, and really cool way to learn something where you got a book. But your cell phone is helping you with the audible part, and it's really, really neat. You're not having to sit at a computer. I've done it at night, while right before bed. I'm sure my wife, she goes, it's driving her crazy. So I'm using headset because otherwise she's like, "What's that one that you're listening to?" And she can't focus on her reading because what I'm doing. So anyway, thanks for bringing up Kroodsma. Appreciate that, Jerry. Thank you so much.
Okay, Cliff.
Okay, bye bye.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and you can give us a call now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. And we have Bill up next. Now, Bill, are you from Center, Texas?
No, I'm from Centennial, Texas.
Centennial.
I'm right on the Ola County Caddo Parish line.
Okay, yeah, they couldn't hear that correct, so they put Central Texas, which, you know, I thought of Center.
No, it's East Texas. I'm about as far as East Texas as you can go with a Louisiana without a Louisiana driver's license.
Gotcha.
Wow.
Okay, and you have a question. What's your question for Cliff?
My question is, I know they've been around for a long time, but when I was a young man or a teenager, we didn't have cattle egrets. And then after I went my tour, the Army had come back. They were here everywhere in the late 60s. Environment. I mean, I've seen a couple of seagulls after a hurricane. You know, around here, but they didn't stay long. You know, they went home.
Right.
But the egrets came from somewhere.
Yeah. So, Bill, I like these kind of calls because you've got a long time perspective. You saw the before and after. As you stated, you saw when we didn't have cattle egrets, and then all of a sudden you came back, and there they are. And so I'm trying to remember the exact year. I want to say it was 1955 or 57 was our first record in Texas, and it was in the Rockport area. And there was a Texas Ornithological Society meeting happening. And the reason I know this, I'm not old enough to have been down there. I was not born in the 50s or the 40s to be able to go to a meeting. But I read about it, and the meeting went bonkers. They all left the meeting to go see this rare bird that had never been seen in Texas, and there was one individual in Rockport, and it disrupted the meeting, and so it was a rarity, and it didn't take long. Within a decade, you know, they came over and they've started breeding and pumping out young and expanding, and that's what you saw the before and after of that, Bill, and so that's
right.
That's pretty neat. So yeah, I don't know as you go away from Rockport inland how far it took them to get to the Piney Woods, but I think within 10 years. And again, I don't know the exact year, but I think it was 55, 57, somewhere in there. So maybe by 1960. Well, you mentioned it. What year did you say you came back from service?
Well, let's see. I was gone from early 60s to 67.
Yeah.
People were calling them new then, you know.
Yeah.
Right.
And they would have. Yeah, they would have been new for them because, you know, somebody saw something in Rockport in the 50s and we didn't hear about it. We didn't have this thing called social media and Facebook and email and texting where things can go viral pretty quick. So. It took a while. That I bet you the birds got here quicker than the news did about them being here. So, but that's pretty cool, Bill. I like hearing that story. How about anything else? Do you have any other birds that
you can It's a beautiful sight. There's a pond near me. I go down, me and the dog go by on the side by side in the evening, and they're roosting, you know, in the trees, and most of the trees have been killed by the building the pond, and they're roosted there.
Yeah.
And they commute.
Right.
From the pond to the fields. And it's a beautiful sight when you see several hundred of them roosting in the trees.
Yeah.
And sundial.
Yeah, that's neat. Cool. Well, that's a great perspective, Bill. I'm glad you're able to call in and tell us that, because, you know, people show up somewhere, they moved to Texas in their 40s just last year, and they're amazed at all these things they're seeing, and they're like, well, I didn't have these back in California. Well, duh, you know, things are really different. You've moved several states away, and the habitat type changes, the terrain changes, and so the bird life is different. So you've got a good long-time perspective, and I appreciate that. So thanks so much for the call, sir.
They're beautiful, and they'll follow a tractor bush hog.
Yeah, that's right.
They know when a meal is coming.
That's right. The bush hog is chopping up grasshoppers and rodents, and they're maimed, and the cattle egret comes in and finishes them off, makes for an easy meal. So that's why they're chasing behind the bush hog. Cool. Very good. Thank you, Bill.
I have a question, though, Cliff. Would DDT have anything to do with this? Were the cattle egrets around, say, 150 years ago?
They were not here.
So they are new arrivals.
Absolutely.
And the question is, why did they decide to vacation here?
They just decided to take a vacation here, and they set up shop just like a lot of people have done. So,
okay. Well, that would be me.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, yeah. You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. And we've got time for a little more calls, but you better get them in quick. And right now we have John from Fishville calling back. John, I hope you're getting a better line now. You're going to have to turn down your radio, John. I'm getting a real echo.
Well, that echo, I've got my radio turned off completely. So we just got telephone line trouble. We've had it for 3 or 4 weeks now since all these storms.
Mm.
Can you hear me at all?
Yes. Yeah, go ahead, John. What's your question?
Okay, Cliff, I got one on you, buddy.
Oh, all right.
Yeah, you were talking about the hay bales and the string they use to tie those bales up.
Right.
That's not tying. I got one of my sons that calls it that. It's twine.
Twine. There. Yeah. I know the bird lingo. I don't know the twine lingo. I apologize. So yeah, you could tell I was searching for that word. Yeah.
I got a real comment I want to ask you about.
Okay.
I just heard on the radio a night or two ago about there's an organization saying we need to turn off our night lights. It's confusing our night migration.
Yeah.
And I'm sure there's a lot to that. But I think it's just silly to think we're going to be turning off some of these night lights. What do you think about that?
Well, we talked about it. We end every show with a conservation tip. And if you go back to our May 2015 episode, 2015, 6 years ago, we talked about that. That lights, extra lights and excess lights should be turned off. We're not talking about feeling unsafe, but we're talking about buildings. High-rise buildings are the biggies, where no one's working and they don't shut off their lights. It has no value to be on, and the birds in typically in bad weather, fog, rain, lightning, etc., they see those lights as a beacon of hey, it's a dark night, but I can see that light coming out of that window on the 32nd floor. And oftentimes they fly right into it. So absolutely darkening the skies is beneficial for birds. The astronomers want the darkened skies because guess what? Light pollution plays havoc on their equipment and their ability to see the celestial bodies up there. So I'm all for it. I think it's really important. So yes, turn off extra lights. You don't need them.
I remember hearing you talk about that on one of those episodes about the tall buildings.
Yep. Yeah. So, okay.
Now I do recall. So.
Great.
It's also amazing, you know, as a kid we used to, you know, we lived in a country town, so we'd drive on the interstate, and you could actually see the glowing dome over cities from quite a distance away. And that's how much light is being emitted from a city landscape at night.
Yeah.
That's a shame. Yeah.
Yep. So, okay, very good. Thank you for the call, John.
Okay. Keep up the good work.
Okay. and thanks for the twine versus tine.
All right. Good
cool.
night, guys.
All right. Thank you.
All right, and you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist. If you get in within the next 30 seconds, you might be able to get on the air. In the meantime, one quick question here. And I've seen native birds in cages for sales at flea markets, and I know it's wrong. So what can I do?
Yeah, so the key word there, he said, was native birds. So we're not talking about, you know, parrots and pheasants and chickens and ducks. White ducks. We're talking about native birds, and we've had that issue. I recall someone sending me a website with a cage full of indigo and painted bunnings for sale near Athens, Texas. Mm. So the thing to do is what I did. You forward that to the local game warden and tell them this is unacceptable. These are native birds, and they're not for caging. They're not for selling. It's completely illegal. So don't call if there's a chicken or a parrot that's not native. The key word there is native. So if you see a cardinal or a blue jay or the painted bunting I mentioned, those are all native, and it's illegal to possess them and certainly illegal to sell them.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. And Cliff, as always, it's time for your conservation tip.
Great. Tonight we're going to talk about wildlife tax valuation. Do you own and pay taxes on acres and acres of rural land? If so, are you enrolled in any of your county's tax valuations like agriculture or timber? The Texas Constitution and Tax Code provide that landowners can receive special tax valuations for certain kinds of farm and ranch land that are appraised based on the land's capacity to grow agricultural products instead of at market value. In almost every case, this appraisal technique substantially reduces taxes owed on ag and timberlands because of its productivity value. In addition to ag and timber valuations, Texans are fortunate to have another valuation option to lower your property taxes, a wildlife valuation. If you own rural land in Texas and are already enrolled in ag or timber valuation, yet you would prefer not to cut your timber regularly or use your land for agriculture, you can transition to specific management activities that encourage healthy wildlife populations, including songbirds. Contact your county's appraisal district office to get more information on a wildlife valuation and to receive the form to make the switch. And if you live in a state without a wildlife valuation, talk to your state's game and fish agency about starting such a program. Having more landowners doing things beneficial to wildlife habitat would be great for all sorts of species. Do it for the birds.
All right. That'll help. All right, and thank you very much, Cliff,
great.
For another great show of Bird Calls.
Thanks, Bill.
You have been listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, here at Red River Radio, and the state ornithologist for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department. We'd like to thank everyone at the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department for their help with this program tonight. Tonight's program is made possible by the Knoll Foundation and the Community Foundation of North Louisiana. Our producers for this show are Bill Beckett and Cliff Shackelford, with phone assistance tonight from Wally Derleth, Sheila Lawrence, and Tim Schnell. The two sound files used in tonight's profile species were from xenocanto.org and were recorded by Andrew Spencer and Paul Marvin. This month's photo on the Bird Calls page was snapped by James Childress. The audio for tonight's program will be posted on our website in about an hour or so, and you can listen to the program again at Red River Radio after I clean up my mistakes, of course. And remember, if you have a photo or a sound clip of a bird that you would like Cliff to identify, you can send that to me at wbeckett@lsus.edu. That's wbeckett@lsus.edu. Be sure to join us for the next installment of Bird Calls on October 12th. This is Red River Radio, and we are your community-supported public broadcasting service from LSUS. This is KDAQ Shreveport-Bossier City, KLSA Alexandria Pineville, KBSA El Dorado Camden Magnolia, KLDN Lufkin Nacogdoches, and KTYK Overton Tyler Kilgore. Stay tuned. Radio Lab is coming up next.